Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our guest is, once again, Mike Shedlock. Mike is a registered investment advisor representative for Sitka Pacific Capital Management. How I know Mike is mostly going to his blog website every day for his very informative commentary on a lot of different subjects. Mike, welcome back to our show.
Pleasure to be back on the show.
When did you start that that website?
I started my blog in 2005. Actually, I had worked in the banking industry for over 20 years. I was an assistant vice president for Harris. I left that in 1999 when I became a consultant. And the consulting jobs dried up after Y2K and then after 9/11. And just overnight, I mean, I was a mainframe computer consultant. The jobs absolutely vanished. I was out of work for close to 3 years, had no money coming in at all. I started a blog with the intent of being discovered. Now, the odds of that happening are, I like to tell people that they're zero. Obviously, they're not zero because I did it, but they are very close to zero because that's not an easy thing to do. And I now get 1.5 to 2 million page hits a month on my blog. And I was really starting writing about the things that I was going through at the time that a lot of people are going through right now. And I could see the bubble in housing building, and people were telling me, you know, cash is mish, cash is trash, blah, blah, blah. Well, when you're out of work and you have no money coming in, cash is not trash. And now all those people that were telling me, you know, cash is trash, you need to buy houses, blah, 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 look at how much money they lost on their houses, and how many of them would like to have that cash back now in their pockets now that they're unemployed. But very few people listened to me. The housing bubble, which Bernanke claimed did not exist, it was very easy for me to see that it did exist. I called the exact top of the housing market on my blog in real time in summer of 2005. Now, some people say, well, you know, Case-Shiller shows that the peak was in 2006. Well, Case-Shiller is actually very lagging, and Case-Shiller only looks at resales. It does not look at new home sales. So what started happening in the summer of 2005 that didn't reflect itself in prices was incentives, huge incentives, you know, free garages, free trips to Europe, free cars, you know, free swimming pool, free landscape upgrades, and the free granite countertops. And it started with granite countertops, and then it got all the way to as big as free pools. Case-Shiller never picked up any of that. So housing did peak, I think, in summer of 2005, and it just took another year for things to start heading down in earnest.
And one of the other bonuses, if you will, is there was an 18% commission to sell a house in Phoenix somewhere around 06. So that's the same type of thing.
Yes, exactly.
A little bit price supportive.
Yes.
You know, one of the things about, and I wasn't really going to touch on this, but one of the things that was very difficult about picking a top accurately in 05, 06, or whatever, was you would have really had to understand the way real estate was being financed. And very few people, I'll put myself included, I didn't understand what a mortgage-backed security was or a CDO or a credit default swap until 07. And then looking back, I just shook my head and went, holy mackerel, what were we thinking? And I guess, you know, one of the things about Bernanke's comment about there's not a bubble, I doubt that he understood the same thing. Do you think that's part of the problem? Was there a disconnect between how things were really being financed and how little the lender cared if anybody really could pay?
It's really hard to say what was going on in that guy's mind. I would love to do an interview with Bernanke and just absolutely trash him. The way I would like to do the interview is as if I was a member of Congress and at one of the Humphrey Hawkins testimonies, you know, get to ask my questions in a very, very pointed way. But he certainly missed the housing bubble. He didn't think there would be a recession. He said the housing prices were supported by fundamentals. That and he used this term that Greenspan used as well. That maybe there's some local froth. they just did not see the role of the Fed's interest rates. So, you know, how much of what Bernanke is saying does he really believe, or is he simply trying to absolve the Fed of guilt? So there's a lot of that going on. He did a very, very self-serving speech last week that I absolutely ripped him to smithereens on, and where, you know, he praised the Fed for doing all of these things to cause the recovery, you know, but he ignored all of the things that the Fed did to cause the bubble in the first place. You know, Greenspan was a veritable cheerleader for housing, you know, preaching, you know, variable interest loans, adjustable rate mortgages, praising derivatives, all the things back that we would look on as silly. But how you knew housing was in a bubble is, you know, one did not need to understand credit derivatives or anything else. One did not need to understand that. All one needed to understand is look at how fast home prices were rising versus how fast wages were rising. Home prices were 3 to 4 standard deviations above rental prices and 3 to 4 standard deviations above wage growth. It's just simply not sustainable. You know, that's how, when you're 3 standard deviations, you know, we're talking, you know, hundreds, thousands of year events here. You know, that's how out of line that home prices were.
Where are we now?
I think we're back close to, but not the trend line. I think we're still perhaps a little bit above it. The tendency, however, is to overshoot to the downside. Should that happen, you know, there's a chance for some real significant declines in places like, you know, California. I look at places like Las Vegas, and my God, you know, home prices look absolutely cheap there. Of course, you know, the bigger the bubble, the bigger the decline. The two biggest bubble areas were, there's so many of them, but Las Vegas, Florida, Phoenix, and a lot of places in California. California still has not corrected to where I think it needs to go to where one would say the valuations are reasonable. California also has, you know, Proposition 13, which is, you know, keeping cap on, or actually, you know, putting a floor a little bit on home prices. So, you know, we'll see. But, you know, some cities are always going to have a premium. Chicago's one of them. New York's one of them. San Diego is another one. These cities are going to have premium because that's where a lot of the jobs are. But there's a difference between premium and 300% and 400% and 3 standard deviations, you know, like we were above norm.
A deviation compares earnings to price?
No, it's a mathematical function of a normalized curve that just shows how insane things are. So a three times normal is an extremely low probability event, and when you get into that condition, you know that you're in a bubble. Australia is in that same situation right now, and Canada is in that, especially Vancouver. China is in that. So, you know, I can look at all these places and just say, my God, you know, home prices are going up faster than rents, faster than people, faster than wage growth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not sustainable. I mean, it can go last, you know, Canada and China have lasted longer than I thought they would. Australia did too, but the bubble in Australia is now popped. The bubble in Australia, excuse me, the bubble in Canada and the bubble in China have yet to pop. I think they will. And I think they're going to, when they do, we're going to see some 50% declines in those countries, just like we did here in the United States.
You know, there's a lot of very smart people, and I know that you probably respect some of them that disagree as far as the direction. You're feeling like we're going to have deflation, and there's a lot of feelings that somehow we have to protect against strong inflation. So what are their arguments, and how do you think that they're viewing it wrong?
Again, before you can debate anyone on any subject, or you can even have a discussion, you have to agree on what the terms mean.
Okay.
I defined inflation and have as an increase in money supply and credit, with credit mark to market, period. That's my definition.
And what usually are the ramifications of that action, in other words?
Well, let me give you another definition. The definition, the most common definition that people use is, you know, inflation is prices going up.
Okay.
And they look at consumer prices. Well, unfortunately, they ignore asset prices, and that's actually one of the mistakes that Bernanke and Greenspan made. They absolutely ignored asset prices. They did not consider home prices as part of inflation. Had you taken home prices, which is what I think you should do, and put them in the CPI, then interest rates on the Greenspan and Bernanke Fed in the initial stages of the bubble popping, interest rates were 5% and 6% too low. You know, if you put housing in the CPI, the CPI would have been something like 8% or 9%, and interest rates instead were 4.5%. So, is there should be no wonder that speculation in homes was running rampant when interest rates are that low. The Fed did not, you know, put them in there. Now, contrary-wise, people tell me, oh, my God, you know, look at look at inflation now. It's going through the roof. Well, is it? If we put home prices in the CPI, now we see, you know, a different kind of thing. CPI would be barely flat here now. This is what happens when you ignore asset bubbles and don't put them in the CPI. And, you know, this is what happens, you know, when you only look at prices. I don't even think it's possible to measure prices. Look at your basket. The Fed has this CPI. This is a basket of goods and services. Well, the basket of goods and services that, you know, someone who's on fixed income and retired, what do they care about? They might care about gasoline prices. They care about their heating bill. They care about property taxes if they own their home. They care about rent prices. They care about the prices of food. They care about the price of drugs and medicine if they're not fully covered by, you know, Medicare, if they've got to pay 20% out of their own pocket. So, you know, take the basket of someone who's got kids in high school heading for college. My God, the cost of college education is, you know, has doubled in the last, you know, 10 years or less. It was $240 a semester when I went to the University of Illinois and got my degree in engineering. You know, it's $14,000 a semester or something like now, and that's not, you know, room and board. You know, someone can easily rack up $50,000 a year in expenses going to college, and so kids are graduating $100,000 in debt. So anyway, my point being here is that someone whose basket includes, you know, a lot of kids, you know, and food prices, and they've got to, you know, haul their, you know, transport their kids all over to soccer games, and they're worried about the price of gasoline, and their health care bill is soaring. That's another different basket. There's no representative basket. This whole idea of even thinking you can measure, you know, the CPI is just flawed.
You have a letter on your website that a lady named Stephanie, who's retired, mm-hmm. And to Stephanie, inflation meant her fixed income bought less stuff.
Yes.
That's basically what inflation meant to her.
Yes. And you know, she says, I get $938 from Social Security. That's what she lives on every month. She's got a CD that has $16,000 in it. She's getting $75 a month on that CD, or she was at the time. Well, interest rates, short-term interest rates are now down to nothing. Someone's getting nothing on $16,000. You know, this is, and you know, Stephanie wrote and asked me for advice. And I responded to her that she was being clobbered by the policies of the Fed. Not only did the taxpayers bail out the banks at tax, not only bail out the banks at their expense, but the Fed continues to do so. When he holds the interest rates this low, he's hurting everyone on fixed income, you know, that has savings in CDs or gets a Social Security check every month that buys less and less and less. You know, those are the people that, you know, Bernanke's hurting.
Norio Rubini just came out and with a statement that he thought that there could be quite a shaking up of bond and yields and so forth in the next couple of years. You agree with that?
I mentioned that possibility, too. I don't know. And it's interesting. I just got an email. Someone sent me a really nasty email. I'm to that very question, I think it was. Someone asked me, you know, and I said, I don't know. And this person got all upset and said, well, why should I bother to read you if you don't know? And I told this person, I said, look, anyone that thinks they know, you know, is full of it. No one knows anything. Mm-hmm. You know, we can put together our guesses with, and we can make a case why we think something's going to happen. But when someone says that they know, they don't know. No one knows. We don't know what the Fed's going to do.
That's right.
We don't know what the ECB is going to do. Mm-hmm. We don't know what China's going to do. And all of this stuff is intertwined. If China's having a government change in 2012. Not a lot of people are aware of that. But it's going to be a very significant one. The current leadership in China is extremely focused on maintaining growth at any price. It's highly rumored that the next regime that's coming in China is extremely concerned about property bubbles. So if they slow the Chinese economy, that slows the prices of commodities, you know, that drops oil, that drops the CPI, you know, and if Congress, you know, sticks to its policies here of being fiscally conservative. You know, yeah, we're still running huge deficits, but we're no longer adding to it. You know, that's a, you know, change in the direction of downward pressure on the dollar. And if you know, Jean-Claude Trichet, everyone expects him to hike next month. Well, if the ECB, they expected him to hike last month and they didn't. Well, if the ECB doesn't hike, that's going to put upward pressure on the dollar and downward pressure on the euro. So all of these things are going out there, and you know, there's all of these variables, and someone that, you know, claims that they know, they're lying, or they're fools, or both. So, you know, I don't know, but I'm very supportive of, nonetheless, I'm supportive of what Rubini said. There is a legitimate chance of a bond market revolt. I talked about that on Yahoo Finance. I was on the air with Aaron Task and Henry Blodgett, and before Rubini mentioned it, I mentioned it about 2 weeks before he did. And I said, if we get another round of QE out of this Fed, yeah, there's a very real risk of a bond market revolt. However, if he doesn't, and if he delays off on that, and there's a stock market plunge, and Europe delays hiking, and Australia does rate cuts, and China slows, and commodities come down, well, then we can see a flight to treasuries. Which one of those is going to happen? You tell me where all those variables, you know, fit on what Congress does, and what China does, and what the ECB does, on what the Fed does, and then, you know, I'll give you a more certain answer.
Let me ask you this. If you were the government of the United States, would you prefer inflation going forward as opposed to deflation?
I would prefer we get rid of the Fed.
Well, I understand, but let's talk about reality. We've got a $14 or $15 trillion deficit. Just in practical sense, when you have deflation, that gets more onerous. And going forward, are they going to attempt to inflate, whether they can or not? I'm not that smart.
Well, they're going to attempt to inflate.
Okay.
What would I prefer? I would prefer they balance the budget. I would prefer we bite the bullet. Otherwise, again, this is the scenario. Now, maybe it doesn't happen next year. But there's a very if the U.S. does not address its budget deficit, there's a very risk of what happened in Greece happening to the United States, where interest rates, just do shoot up. And that's a very, very real risk. And if we want to get back to growth policies, we need to balance the budget. And we need to do some things. I think we could cut the military. I mean, we're spending $750 billion on defense. Well, we could probably spend $100 billion and have enough defense if we weren't fighting all these stupid wars. But let's be more realistic and just chop a couple hundred billion off. That's one thing we could do. We could lower, we could allow drug imports, coming in from Canada. We can get rid of student loans. We can actually kill the entire Department of Energy. What do we need it for? It's totally useless. So, there are a lot of things that we could do that would get this country back on fiscal track. And I don't think one would want to balance the budget in 1 year, but I certainly think that someone can do it in 5 years. And there's not really a choice here. You're acting like as if there's a choice. If we continue on the current path of not tackling the deficit, then what's going to eventually happen? But I won't give you the year, is something like what happened in Greece. The path that we are on is unsustainable. The sooner the Congress addresses that, the better. But the sooner they address that, that's going to negatively impact housing, that's going to negatively impact commercial real estate prices, going to negatively impact the stock market, blah, blah, blah. No one wants to see that. No one wants the short-term pain. But the long-term pain gets greater and greater and greater. Just as happened in Greece, if we don't address the problem.
Anything, we only have 2 minutes left. Anything about Japan's 20-year run is very similar to what we are about to experience or are experiencing?
I think, and I've said for years that the U.S. has been following the path of Japan. It seems like we're still on that path, and I think even if the Fed does manage to, get a little bit more inflation, which they seem to be hell-bent on doing, that because of deleveraging of consumers, that home prices are probably going to not go anywhere in real terms for a decade. So all the people out there that are thinking, housing's close to a bottom, I'd better buy now, home prices are going to shoot back up, I would say forget about it, that we're not going to have hyperinflation, that home prices are going to be stagnant here for a long, long time.
All right, Mike, we're just about ready to wrap up. Go ahead and give your information again on your website.
My website is globaleconomicanalysis.blogspot.com. That is a mouthful. The easy way to find me, just do a Google search for Mish, M-I-S-H, first two characters of my first and last name, Mike Shedlock. So do a Google search for Mish. You'll find me. I talk about housing, interest rates, Europe, gold, silver, the global economy, every day of the week.
Mike, thanks so much.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.